This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life, with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
Hello, Sunny Bonani, Guten Tag, Goeiedag, Bonjour. Any greeting that you want to do in any part of the world. Hello, I am Saul Smith. I'm standing in for Gary Hertzberg today, and this is The Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Alongside me today on the decks, we've got Palesa, as usual, and we have Lionel Makokotlela. Hello, Lionel.
Hello, Saul and Palesa, our flower of the day. And yeah, well, welcome, Saul, to...
To the hot seat.
Yeah, to the hot seat, yeah. Thank you. Just about to say the hot seat, and I hope then you buckle up.
All right, well, I'm completely strapped in. Today, we continue our collaboration with Legal Talk South Africa.
Certainly.
Which is an initiative that wants to bring affordable legal advice to the public through one of their various channels. They have a mobile application. They have a very, very active Facebook page. And they also have a website. The Facebook page, you can ask questions and sort of crowdsource the legal opinion from other members of the public who've been there, who have the experience, and also from people who have expertise, who have studied, and who are, I think there are a few attorneys on that site too.
True that.
Mm-hmm. They have a pay site, which is legaltalksa.co.za. There you can pay a minimal fee to get a legal opinion from a practicing attorney. I think it's a very minimal fee. I think it's 180 Rand, yes. Which is very reasonable when you consider that, like, most of us won't answer the phone for 180 Rand.
Did you just say most, not you, Carl? Because you're, like, very expensive.
Oh, I'm extremely expensive.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You get what you pay for.
No, certain. And beside that, they actually have, like, different attorneys who specialize in different fields. So there's legal for... let's say law when it comes to malpractice attorneys, labor laws, property, because last week we actually had somebody in for from the property division, and they just do various legal shows in that regard. And I think the public should actually familiarize themselves with the platforms and really take advantage of it. And they do have, of course, Facebook, which is what most people tend to utilize to get their questions out there.
Absolutely, Lionel. Even as just a first line of information, because a lot of people will go to an attorney and not really know anything. They've just got a situation. Here, at least, you can mitigate those costs. You don't have to consult for 2 hours. You can consult for half an hour, because you've got a little bit of understanding of what should happen and what has happened.
True that.
So today we are going to be focusing on some of the labor questions that have come up on the Facebook page posted by members of the public and members of the Legal Talk South Africa Facebook group. Joining us in studio today, we have, ladies first, we have Jackie Perkis from the Fair Labor Practice. Welcome back, Jackie.
Hi, thank you.
And we also have Chilisanani Mukwevo from Labor Law Enterprise.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you. Can I call you Chili?
Chilisanani will do.
Chilisanani will do. Okay.
Yes. And our contact details is at Hertz Law. That's basically our Twitter handle, HERTZLAW. And you basically do the Cliff Central, the Laws of Life on Facebook. That's your show. Then you actually have to do the voicing.
Right, so you can find us on Facebook at The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg.
Yes.
Thanks, Lionel.
Cool.
Chilisanani, do you want to just give us a little bit about yourself? What's your background? Where you came from?
Okay. Like I said, my name is Chilisanani. Background, education, BCom Law, University of the Western Cape. Grew up in Mafikeng. Born in Venda in Limpopo, worked here in Joburg, so I've been quite around. Been practicing now for 2 years. 2 years and 2 months now.
Practicing as a?
A labor consultant.
As a labor consultant. Yeah. Why labor?
Actually, that was by default, actually. What happened is, it's by default, but actually it's almost as if the dots joined. What happened at varsity is, you know, first year you get to varsity, you just do whatever, and it's time to pick majors. And then I saw industrial psychology. I'm like, what's this? It was economics. I know economics. So industrial psychology, what's this? Picked it, okay. Graduated, and then moved to Joburg from Cape Town. And then it was time to apply. Saw a job. I was like, okay.
So you just took it and you rode with it.
I don't even think I would get in. You know that thing of when you're just web browsing, you see something, and you're like, ah.
Well, when you're unemployed, you apply for for every single job, and whichever one comes first, you're like, I'll do that.
Exactly. I applied the afternoon. In the morning, I got a call to come through, and then the rest is history, I guess.
As they say. That's a pretty good story. 2.5 years in the industry, that's good. Jackie, I know you've been in the industry a little bit longer than that.
A tad longer. The Fair Labour Practice has been open and running around for the last 15 odd years. I don't have a legal background. I have a streetwise background rather than education. I do have a diploma in arbitration alternative dispute resolution through AFSA and University of Pretoria, which I surprised myself by passing cum laude. But I love what I do, and that's, I think, where the difference is.
But prior to the Fair Labour Practice, you spent many years in HR and industrial relations.
That's correct, with the Control Instruments Group. I was there for about 20-odd years.
Wow.
I'm sort of one of those that stays and stays and stays.
Part of the furniture until they retrenched you.
That's right.
Okay, we're going to be answering questions that have been placed on the Facebook page, but Chili Sonani wanted to talk a little bit about a little bit of case law that came out recently.
Yeah.
We normally get carried away with these questions, so I think maybe we should just dedicate 5 or 10 minutes to this little bit of interesting case law. You say it's Harvey versus Neyland Labour Court.
Neyland versus Harvey, yeah.
Okay.
It's at the Labour Court. It was taken on review at the Labour Court.
Mm.
What really took me by this case is it's constructive dismissal. So
very difficult to prove.
Exactly. Because now, since I started, you know, working as a labor consultant, I've never seen a case where a person wins such a case, constructive dismissal. So now, my thing, or beef rather, has always been, why do they have it? Because it's almost as if no matter what you do, you will not win. Right? So now, this case, if I wasn't aware of constructive dismissal, I would assume that this person was constructively dismissed. If I read it, you know, face value.
Let's just give the listeners an idea of what constructive dismissal is, because a lot of people get this wrong. Should we go around the table, Lionel? Have you got any idea?
No, I don't. Actually, I wanted actually ask the question, because constructive dismissal to me just sounds like more like you being pushed out of the working environment due to circumstances. Let's say, for example, your employer has got beef with you, and they simply now start micromanaging you and start complaining about each and every tiny little thing that you do. And that could actually lead to you being deciding to resign, not necessarily that you wanted to, but because they are just basically pushing you off the cliff, as the one would call it that. But I'm not quite sure if that would actually stand in the definition.
It's really where the employer renders the relationship intolerable. So the employer does stuff that the employee simply can't stand. But it's very difficult to prove because it's subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And the employer has the prerogative to manage its business as it sees fit, obviously within reasonable and lawful grounds. But often relationships do sour. Mm-hmm. We know this. Obviously personal and work relationships go sour. But sometimes the employer is seen as the boogeyman, but it's not really so. It's actually the individual manager of the employer who's accountable for doing all this stuff about making a person's life completely intolerable at work. But the test is, what is intolerable?
Mm-hmm.
And what did you do about it? So if you are the receiver of the intolerability, what did you do to try and remedy the situation before doing the resignation number and then coming to the CCMA or the Labour Court for help? So it's important that people understand that if your boss is being mean to you, you need to take some form of remedial action. You need to say, whoa, stop that conduct. I don't like it. Please help me with this. I don't understand that. Whatever it might be. So you can't just back yourself into a corner and expect a resignation and then a commissioner to give you a whole bag full of money, because it's not going to work like that.
But let's just try to tackle this. If the employer is actually putting pressure on you, do you have to talk to them or do you speak to the HR manager?
Because well, in a lot of companies there is no HR. So you would raise your concern with the person who's aggrieving you. Mm-hmm. So you would raise a grievance. Now, in my view, I mean, in my experience as an HR person for a long time, people don't like raising grievances because they say they'll be victimized.
Exactly.
This, that, and the next thing. It's nonsense. If you have a grievance and it's real, you will put it in writing and you will stand by it and you will fight for your cause. Because otherwise, what's the point? For me, if you're not prepared to write it down and speak about it and take it to its proper conclusion, then it's just a gripe.
So it's a fruitless exercise.
Yeah, and it's just a gripe, and you're just being grumpy, and you're not prepared to try and help resolve it, because you also have to be part and parcel of the resolution. Because where there's a problem, there's two or more people involved. One of them is you. Mm. So you might be the cause of that problem. In many cases, employees who raise these issues and won't go to the grievance stage are themselves problematic.
Wow. Absolutely true. And I can also just add that, you know, a lot of times people confuse resignation and constructive dismissal. Because it's one thing if maybe, say, I'm being bullied by Saul, for example. Say we work together, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
He bullies me all the time.
Every day.
And I just keep quiet. I keep to myself. And then it comes to a point where I'm like, you know what? I have to leave here. I write down a resignation letter saying that, you know what, I've been very happy here. Things have been wonderful. But I feel that, you know, I have to pursue other ventures. And then turn around and say...
You pushed me out.
You pushed me out.
Well, CCMA, I mean, just your resignation letter shot you in the foot. You
exactly.
said, I've had such a wonderful time here. And now you're saying it was horrible.
Exactly.
Contradiction.
Because now, I think a lot of times, it's more of... What you call it... I'm not trying to, you know, press or pin on anyone, but a lot of times is you'll find that we never really grow up. We just become grown-up children. So whatever issues that you had as a child, they will sort of follow you into adulthood. So now if I was bullied as a child and I never learned how to...
And you always feel like a victim.
Exactly. So now should someone do something to me, already I'll feel like, oh my God, why me? They're out to get me.
Well, let's bring this back to Nilind versus Harvey.
Exactly.
So this case is scandalous. I mean, it's such a funny story. It's just crazy. Do you want to outline the case? Or?
Absolutely, I can do that.
Okay.
So the case goes as follows. Can I just use
person A and B?
Person A and B. Person A applies for a job at person B. They get a job as a hunter. So they work there all as well. Person B being the employer.
So they work together on the lodge.
Exactly, yeah. On the farm.
Right.
As a, you know, hunter. Person A has a wife.
And person B
person
has
B
a wife.
Also has a wife. Hmm. Right?
Saucy.
And then what happens is person B, who's the employer, then now has an affair with A's wife. Right.
So the boss is having an affair with his employee's wife.
Exactly. Right. And then, what's it called? Person B's wife finds out and she's like, you know what? I'm not having any of this.
She decides, she leaves.
She divorces him. She leaves. She's like, you know what?
Good for her.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Person A is, you know what, hurt, but then he doesn't resign. He's like, you know what?
Life, it's life.
Yeah.
So he's cool with this.
Well, he's not, well, cool,
not cool, cool, but yeah.
You nap it in the butt.
Exactly. Yeah. So they have a discussion, quote unquote. They go back to working together, all as well.
And that goes on for another 2 years.
Exactly.
They work together happily for another 2 years.
But the affair still continues.
He doesn't know.
He doesn't know. Mm. Right? And then what happens is they one night they go to a bar.
This is the employer and the employee. Yeah. Yeah. They go to the bar.
So they're actually social friends.
Exactly.
They hunt together.
And also chill.
Yeah, they drink together.
They drink together.
Yeah.
So now, as what happens at bars, alcohol, whatever, they...
A little bit of lubricant and alcohol.
Yeah, they get into a dispute. What's it? Person A then now writes on Facebook, you know what, I think it's time for me to pursue other ventures. So he gets another job at a neighboring farm. He resigns. Cool. And then there was issues about ownership of whatever, because they even at one point
they had bought a company together.
Yeah, they bought a farm together. So you know, things were okay.
Sorry, yeah. Are these business partners or employer and employee?
At this stage, they're both.
Oh, okay.
They have a business together, and in a separate business, the one is the employee.
Oh, okay. Other. All right.
So now, you know, Facebook people write whatever. So he says, you know what, moving on to what you call it.
So long story short, he ducks.
Exactly.
He writes on Facebook, I'm leaving. He gets another job, and then he goes.
Exactly.
And then he comes to the court it's got to be within 30 days.
Exactly.
He goes to the CCMA, and he says, you drove me out because you're sleeping with my wife.
Exactly.
You drove me out. So flaw number one with his case, he's already got a job by the time he leaves. So he's leaving to another job, and that's why he's leaving.
It's not because of the affair.
It's not because it's intolerable. He lived with the affair for ages. So, I mean, in my mind, it's pretty clear that he left to pursue other ventures. Mm-hmm. He didn't leave because he hated his boss.
Absolutely.
So pretty cut and dry there.
Yeah, but then now they took it on review.
Mm.
And then still, they still said the same thing at review.
Mm.
But you know what? Had it been so intolerable, you could have left. Your actions would have shown that, you know what, it is intolerable. But no, you stayed for another 2 years. So now, by you staying, you're sort of saying that, no, I'm cool with it. You can't just say, after 2 years, no, actually, 2 years ago, I was very hurt. So let's backtrack a bit to 2 years ago, and let's try to get a defense based on 2 years ago. It doesn't really work like that.
No, it doesn't.
So really, like, you know, construct dismissal, like it is.
It's got to be intolerable.
Exactly.
And it's got to be intolerable at the time that you leave. And you have to have done something about it.
Exactly. Which a lot of people don't do.
Correct.
They just up and throw a tantrum and say, ah, I'm out of here.
I don't know if you noticed in the judgment, they have reference to 500 pages of documents that were submitted to court.
Absolutely.
And the judgment is 2 pages.
Mm-hmm.
500 pages. Can you imagine being a magistrate or a judge who has to deal with that kind of submission?
Yeah, no, it was absolute nonsense. In fact, when I read the judgment, I was quite surprised that he had the guts to take it that far.
Mm.
Well, maybe he's just plain thick. Sorry, in my view. Not without besmirching anyone's character, but the intolerability carried on for 2 years because his wife continued to have the affair behind his back anyway, despite them having forgiven each other and done all these things. And it was public knowledge. People knew about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so he couldn't have not known about it for all that time. So there was nothing intolerable there. It was just, I think, that he was probably embarrassed.
Yeah, and I think towards the end it was a very acrimonious relationship between the two, because there was other litigation between the parties. In the Madge Court and all the way to the Supreme Court of Appeal. And what's interesting about those cases was an attempt to enforce a restraint of trade, which was successful. But what was really interesting about that case was that the court allowed person A, the employer, to use... Was the employer person B?
Employer person B.
Okay. Person B to use messages off of person A's Facebook account that he had gotten unlawfully. He had his employee's password. He logged into his employee's Facebook account. He stole the messages, downloaded the private messages,
mm-hmm.
and printed them out and used that as evidence in the court. And the court said, even though you got it illegally, as a violation of privacy, we can still accept this evidence into court. Very interesting. You can sue him later for invasion of privacy, but right now we're happy to use it. Okay, so that's constructive dismissal and Harvey and Nieland and scandalous.
Very.
Let's move on to let's move on to the questions that we've gotten off Facebook. There's a whole section on probation. People don't really seem to understand what probation is and how it works and why we have it and how different it is to real employment. So here's question one. This comes from Comfort, and he says, can the employer dismiss an employee who is still on probation without a hearing? Now, one person answers, a fellow called Andre. He says, probation means a trial period with the intention of possible employment. I don't know if the employer can terminate probation at any time before it ends, but I know that the employer is under no obligation to employ the possible employee to be. Okay, so let's go ladies first.
Well,
what's
I'm not
wrong
sure
with that statement?
I don't agree with that rather sweeping statement. Probation is an opportunity for both parties to see if they're going to fit. Obviously, it's not a one-sided thing. The employer has all the power. The employee also brings a set of skills to the workplace and generates power through that. So the probation is really an opportunity for the parties to see whether that relationship is going to work. More from a performance point of view, from do we like each other? It's not necessarily a marriage, but obviously you've got to be able to work together. And whether this person can actually bring those skills and give the outputs that's been promised in the interview. And also whether the employer is able to pay for those services in the way that has been promised and all those things. Now, in my view, probation, you do need to have some form of, not micromanaging, but feedback sessions on a regular basis. Saying, this is great, that's lousy, fix this, I love it, whatever. And your employees should also be given an opportunity to say, well, I don't like the way you speak to me in the morning and I'd wish you'd greet me and all these things. And then once you've had those at least over a three-month period, six meetings, I would say every 2 weeks, you then can confirm employment. But if it's not working, at least you've let your employee know up front that it's not working. And it's unlikely then that the relationship will continue unless certain things are met. And all of that should be documented in writing. And I know my clients are near them pulling their hair out, saying, oh, I've got so much to do already, I don't have to do all of this. But that's about the relationship. And in fact, probation ends and that doesn't change anything. You still have to have feedback sessions. You still have to talk to your employees and they're back to you. So the relationship is permanent right from the beginning, really. And you have to be talking to each other about what's not working and what is working. And if you do want to dismiss a probationary employee, you have to give them an opportunity to say why they shouldn't be dismissed. It doesn't have to be a formal disciplinary hearing. But it does have to be an opportunity to be heard. And you'd be amazed. Some employees come up with some very inventive ways of not being dismissed. They can give you input. They can cry, scream, plea, whatever. But you need to hear them.
So the short answer, can the employer dismiss an employee who's still on probation without hearing? No.
I'd say no.
No. A hearing basically means the opportunity to be heard, as you said.
Correct. It doesn't have to be a formal chairperson and witnesses and the whole megillah, but it does have to be an opportunity to state a case.
Okay.
It sounds procedurally correct. It really does.
Not exactly.
Chili Sanani has a view. Yeah.
Not exactly, because remember, like the lady said, probation really... it's just for the employee to show their capability, right? And then the employer as well to give feedback on whatever they've put in. Right?
With the potential of being employed permanently.
Exactly, right.
But if then you feel that somebody is not living up to that expectation and they don't know that they're not living up to the expectation, the least you can do is to call a meeting so that you actually voice your unhappiness and try to address those so that they can actually be mitigated.
Okay.
Because if you then... dismiss somebody without actually having that hearing, it might actually cause you problems when it goes to the CCMA, because they want to know what sort of procedures were done. If then the person was not actually coming in late all the time, and they were supposed to be coming at this specific time, did you really try and sit down with them and have a counseling meeting? Because those things actually also add up to one's advantage.
It's very similar to a performance enhancement program. Exactly. For the first 3 months. You've got to assess, give feedback, and improve. But that said, just to clarify, when you are employed on probation, you are employed. It's not like you've got a fixed term contract or a temporary employment. Absolutely. If you're employed on probation, you are an employee.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and you have rights that go with employment.
Absolutely. The procedural requirements might be a little bit less onerous on the mm-hmm. employer for that probationary period, a little bit less onerous, but you can't just out of the blue say, it's not working, get out.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, come the end of March, cheers, you're out of here today. It's your last working day. I mean, it's a big fat surprise.
Yeah.
So it doesn't work like that.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, it does, but it shouldn't.
I think we need to move along a little bit quicker. Wow, it's been great. 25 minutes in already, and we have answered one question. It's really interesting, though. Here's another question about probation from Jade. She says, I started working at the end of last month and was put on 1 month probation till this Friday, as the contract states. So now this weekend it's stock take, and all staff must be there. Do I count as staff?
That's a tricky one.
Well,
lawyers, people who have actually dealt with this?
I guess not. Because if her contract ended on Friday, unless it's been renewed, it ended.
So is it a fixed term contract? If she had a 1 month contract, then
it
she had a 1 month
contract.
It sounds
to me like a fixed term contract.
It wasn't a probationary contract, it was a 1 month contract, perhaps.
You know, when I read this question, I wrote down a few notes saying that, you know what, I'm a bit confused, or I don't really understand the question. Like you said, is it a fixed term? Is it probation? If it's fixed term, it'll say you'll be employed from this date up until this date. If it's probation, is it probation in a what you call it, employment contract saying that you'll be on probation for so long, and then after probation you'll be a full time employee? Or how does it now really work? Because now there are two sides.
I think this is a fixed term, is a probationary period disguised as a fixed term contract, which is against the spirit of the law.
Yep. Which happens frequently with employers entering into these so-called fixed term contracts in order to avoid their obligations.
Mm.
In terms of the Labour Relations Act, I hate those contracts. I think if you're going to enter into a fixed term contract, there's got to be a good reason for it. In other words, the project is starting on Monday and it's finishing on Friday. And after that, the project is finished. Then there's a good reason for a fixed term. But it's not so that I can assess whether you're going to fit into my company or not. That's a probation.
And then another thing is that you'll find that what employers do is they will give you a probation, quote-unquote, period, and then keep on extending the probation, not in good faith, mm-hmm. but because to exclude you from certain rights that would be accrued to you should you be a permanent employee. So, you know, it's what employers do, unfortunately. And because people don't know, they go with the flow and say, oh no, it's fine, I'm still on probation. And then come a month five, they're being told that, ah, no, sorry, it's not working out, pack your things, go. And then it's a thing of, but then
I've been on probation for 2 years, what are you doing here?
Exactly. You're not telling me what's wrong, you're not giving me feedback, so... Yeah, unfortunately.
So when is it acceptable to sort of extend a probationary period?
Okay, if maybe, you know, you see that there's room for, there's progress, but you're not really satisfied.
You're not quite there yet.
Yeah.
So it's 3 months, but you're there, but...
Yeah,
you know,
you're not... So I want to just extend
two things
it.
I need you to fix. You need to do this better.
Exactly,
and better.
Before I can confirm that, you know what, either full-time employment or it's not working out.
Yeah.
So it's just to give you more time to
reach the standard.
And that's very reasonable, because you don't want to just cut someone at the knees because they didn't do one thing out of
you didn't send your emails out early
exactly.
enough in the morning.
But then your work is satisfactory. It's just that thing of maybe time frame, but then everything else is good. So you're actually like, let us just increase it a little bit so that you get that trend.
So in that case, it is it's lawful and reasonable to extend that.
Absolutely.
Sure, as long as you're having the feedback sessions with people, that right, it doesn't just happen at the end of the period. Oh, by the way, you're no good.
Yeah. I fully agree with your statement. Yeah. And I also think then it's very important that you outline the duties that the person ought to do on their probation, just so that when you measure, you've got something that you say, but this is what we had actually agreed on, and you are actually meshing it, or you are actually underperforming, and as a result, we think this is what you need to do.
I think that's important all the way through your employment relationship.
Certainly.
All the way through. More so. Because when you're a new employee, you come to the employer with bells and whistles. I mean, you are going to sell yourself. That's the whole point.
True.
So you're going to say, yes, I can answer the switchboard and I can switch on the computer and all these things. Listen, I started at Control Instruments and as a temporary secretary, and they asked me if I could use some machine. I said, I can use any machine. And they took me on. And it took me the whole morning to find the on switch for that blasted computer. I'd never seen a system like that in my life before. But eventually I got it.
And you were willing to learn. And you were willing to learn.
Sure.
And you got to go the extra mile because...
Well, I did. I marketed myself. Exactly. That was really, you know, it was about getting the job rather than doing the job to start with. I needed to get it first.
You can undersell and over-deliver in some cases, but in most cases just...
Well, if you undersell, no one's buying.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's not legal. let's move on quickly. Quick question about retrenchment. There's a man called Tseko. He says, they retrenched us at work, and I stayed at home for 3 weeks. At the consultation meeting, they promised us severance pay, a golden handshake, and external training. And now, they've asked me to start work on a different plant with a new contract. Is the employer still going to pay what he promised me?
I can take a stab at it. What's it called? I don't know. He shouldn't get severance pay because he's not retrenched.
His employment is continuing.
Exactly.
Or his alternate work has been found.
Exactly. Because I think people should remember that when you're being retrenched or the process of retrenchment, it's not a thing of one morning, boom, you're retrenched. No, there's a consultation process where they say to you that, you know what, the job that you are doing has now been... it's now redundant.
Hmm.
So now we have other positions that you can take, or do you have anything in mind that you think you can take or you can do, and then we can put you there. So in his instance, or she, I'm not sure, they have found an alternative position for him in the company still. It's just a different plant. So there's no need for severance pay, golden handshake, because his continuous employment, it's not... what you call it, has not been ended. Has just been altered. Almost said modified.
Altered
a bit, and then continued his employment. So there's no need for severance pay, golden handshake, and all other things that he mentioned.
I wasn't clear on that question as to the 3 weeks at home number.
Yeah.
That sounded a bit sort of
strange.
Was it paid leave, unpaid leave?
Well, it should be paid. It should. Absolutely. He should absolutely be paid for his 3 weeks off. Absolutely, mm-hmm. Without a doubt. It's not like he wanted to be on leave for 3 weeks.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, Tseko, get your 3 weeks and carry on with your job.
Absolutely.
Okay, here's a question from Kavisha. This is mostly about disciplinary hearings. She says, what is the maximum period an employee can be suspended pending a disciplinary hearing?
Ooh.
So let's talk about the suspension first. You're not always suspended, are you?
Nope.
Are we talking about... private company or government? Because in government you can be suspended for years.
Yes. Yeah, no, hence I was just about to say, it all depends. And it also depends what sort of position you occupy, because that might actually bring a lot of complex situation or merits to the case. So it all depends.
Okay, so let's go with the private.
Yeah,
let's,
please.
Let's call it a private company.
The suspension is generally put in place in order to protect the company's interests, and also maybe in some cases to even protect the employee from him or herself. And it's usually, and I would only recommend that it be on full pay, because otherwise you have to get agreement, and I can't see an employee agreeing to be suspended without pay.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's, and it does happen, but that's punishment, that's putting the cart before the horse.
Mm.
But then now, if it's without pay, then that would mean that, that's the punishment in itself.
Correct.
For the misconduct that you had done. So it's
for which the hearing is only going to be.
So it's predetermined. It's prejudging, yeah.
Or even after the hearing, where they say that we're not going to dismiss you, or we're not going to give you a final written warning, but the sanction is no pay.
Well, that would also, you'd have to agree to that. You'd have to get an agreement from the employee.
That would be part of a sanction. And I have seen sanctions like that. You're going to go on 3 weeks without pay. No dismissal.
Mm-hmm.
It is an alternative to dismissal, which is what the Act encourages you to do. Find something short of dismissal where you can.
Mm.
So there are people that get punished by way of unpaid leave. Or they won't receive their salary for a month. I don't think it's very fair because it creates hardship unnecessarily.
So let's talk about before the inquiry. Before an inquiry, not as a punishment.
Okay.
Would you be suspended during an investigation, perhaps?
Yeah,
it should.
Because if I'm the crook, and all of my info is on my computer, and you want to investigate it, you don't want me there, so that I can hide everything, so I can brief my compatriots, my accomplices.
Yeah,
you want me to go home so that you can finish your investigation, and then call me in to answer the questions.
Absolutely,
great.
Because it might breed conflicts of interest.
So how long would be reasonable? I mean, I guess every how long is a piece of string?
Yeah. Exactly. True.
Well, the shortest possible length of time, in my view, is better.
Yes.
So you really ought to work hard at completing your investigation. If it's very complicated, if it needs forensics, it might go longer. But I wouldn't like to suspend for longer than a week. Right. Remember, it's costing you money.
Yeah, you're paying for this guy to sit at home and work.
And not work, rather.
Maybe yourself reputational damage and stuff like that. So the shorter period, always the better.
So he started up a little competition for you on the side while he's suspended and you're paying him. It's brilliant. Let's move on. So you say as short as possible, yeah. But there's nothing in law that says how long it can be.
I think in some of the bargaining council main agreements, there might be limits on suspension.
Yeah. So what a bargaining council main agreement is a document that it basically overrides the Basic Conditions of Employment Act for specific sectors. So, for example, the mining sector, they've got a main agreement, and their terms of employment are slightly different to, say, the teachers. So they've each got their own agreed terms of employment.
Yep.
So that's a little nugget.
And sometimes in your collective agreements as well, if you have a unionized workforce, the collective agreement may also stipulate periods of suspension for disciplinary action.
Yep. Okay. I agree.
Her next question is, an employee was told that they are told verbally that they are being placed on paid leave. And payday was last Friday, and the employee has not been paid. Should the employee escalate the matter to a more senior person in the organization or report the matter directly to the CCMA? So I don't want to get involved in the question. What's interesting here is that they've said, should we report the matter to the CCMA?
No.
Silly.
No. Like, for what? To the CCMA to do what? Because they have not wronged you. The company has 7 days to pay you. If maybe you're supposed to get paid on the 30th, the company still has 7 days grace period to pay you. So they're actually not in the wrong in any place here. So you go to CCMA and say what?
What, they haven't paid me.
And the CCMA doesn't have jurisdiction over matters concerning remuneration.
So if you're not paid for a month, you don't go to the CCMA, you go to the Labour Department.
Correct, yes. Absolutely.
Except that if you earn more than the threshold earnings, the Labour Department will not help you.
Yeah. Then you go to the court.
Yep. Then it becomes then a court. Civil litigation.
Okay. Here's her next question is, should the employee wait to get dismissed in absentia and then refer the matter to the CCMA, or can the employee request a labor lawyer to send a letter prior to dismissal? So I'm not quite sure what the context here is. It seems like she doesn't want to go to her disciplinary inquiry. It seems as if they're suspended. They're sitting at home, and they've been called to an inquiry, and they don't want to go.
Well, in my view, if you are summoned to an inquiry and you don't go, it can be heard in your absence.
True.
Unless you've got a very good reason for not being there, one of which is that the bus ran over you and you're in hospital, or you got arrested for doing the cocaine last night and now you're in jail, so you can't get to the inquiry.
But if you can make it,
but if you can make it and you don't go, then you're basically waiving your rights to a fair hearing.
You're saying I don't have a defence.
Yeah. In a nutshell, you're pretty much saying I'm guilty.
And then you land up at the CCMA, and then is it a rehearing or?
It would be a rehearing. The commission is obliged to open a case at the request of the applicant. I would love it if the people who do open cases could counsel those employees who have misperceptions of what the CCMA really can do and can't do. Then their caseload might not be as high.
Yes, because it is quite high.
But on that scenario, it doesn't sound like she's got a very meritorious case, like it's going to happen for her.
And then can I just add on to what you just said regarding the CCMA and its process, or its purpose rather, is that people tend to think that because the CCM is free, because they don't pay anything, should whatever happen, they can just go to CCMA.
Got nothing to lose.
Hence why you'll find that CCMA, it's very backed up with cases where there really is no case, because someone will do something and then be disciplined for it and then run to the CCMA.
Yeah. What you must remember is that the CCMA, all those cases are on public record.
Yep.
So I know that you're not supposed to look, but employers do look. And if you've been to the CCMA 6-7 times, they're going to know.
It raises alarm.
And it's very easy to find information from the CCMA.
Very
just
easy.
From the call center itself.
You phone the call center, you've got an ID number, you say, how many cases? And they'll say 3.
Or even just say that, can I get a status of a case? They'll ask you, do you have a case number, ID number? Say, I have an ID number. And then you give them the ID number, they will give you the case number and as to what happened.
Because it is public record.
Exactly. And if you like, you can go to the CCMA in town, if it's in Joburg, uplift the file, because you can do that, and then look as to what happened. So anybody really can do that. And people, don't know that.
Very interesting.
That you can actually go and uplift the file of so whoever.
If you, so if you don't have a case, don't go.
Don't go to the CCMA, please.
Don't go. I absolutely 100% agree with you. Here's a question from Damon. Good day. Is it allowed for the chairman attending the hearing and making the decision whether you get dismissed or not, work for the company and not be from an independent party? So do you have to have a chairperson who's from outside the company, or can someone from within the company make that decision?
From outside the company.
Outside. Independent person.
Well, that's always preferable, because both Chili Sanani and I probably do that for a living. So, yes, please bring them to us, people. But you can have internal chair people, provided they're trained, they understand their mandates, provided they have not been involved in the incident. So in a large company, you can have 7 departments, and you could get somebody from somewhere else to come and chair the hearing.
So you've got the guy from the ops manager chairing the inquiry for the creative department.
Sure, can happen.
Absolutely. Because he doesn't know the person, he doesn't know the situation.
Doesn't know the what's happened.
Couldn't that also just raises the question of conflict of interest? Because I'm coming as a senior and trying to be independent, yet I'm employed by this organization, and I'll be seen looking after the interests of the organization.
No, your question, your statement's really good. Of course, your first duty is to look after your company.
Yes.
And your employer. But in disciplinary hearings, when you have internal people chairing hearings, they should have the wherewithal to come to a fair conclusion, which might not be what the employer wants.
Or the employee wants.
Or the employer.
Okay.
The employer is looking for dismissal. And I'm working in the chemistry department, and Chili Tanani is downstairs in the garage, and I chair an inquiry, and I find him not guilty. The employer's pissed off with me, but that's tough. That's part and parcel of the
question.
We work.
That really does beg the question. If you get an external chairperson, who pays him? The company.
The company.
I often, when I chair inquiries, I'm told, well, you paid by the company, so you can't be unbiased. I'm saying, well, actually, I don't have to be paid by the company. You can pay me too. So if you'd like to split the bill 50-50, I'd be happy with that. But there's no employee who's ever offered to pay my bill.
No, it's a very complex one, but I think it's one that really needs to be interrogated further, because most of the time, if I'm employed within Cliff Central and I have to chair a meeting of a disciplinary hearing about another employee who worked in the same organization, conflict of interest might actually come out or start simmering in there.
Well, it could be an allegation, but you see, when you make an allegation of, for instance, an apprehension of bias or conflict of interest, you need to prove it. So you'd have to argue that. You'd have to say why you are making the statement. And the chairperson would have to sit back and think about it and come back with an answer. Either accuse herself, or in Shilis Anani's case, himself, or say, I'm not biased. I have no cause to be biased. I know nothing about the case. I don't know you. I've never met the other party. I'm going to hear it.
Okay. Sounds fair enough.
Well, someone's got to pay.
Yeah.
And just because someone's paying me doesn't mean I'm going to give them exactly what they want. Right?
No. But if it's an independent person, I'm saying big up. But as somebody working internally, I reserve my reservations.
Okay, so you're not going to chair the Gareth Cliff chair?
No, I wouldn't. no. I would excuse myself, and I would just simply say, rather get somebody who's an independent and somebody qualified who can actually chair this.
Look, it's obviously the best solution, yes. But there's smaller companies that can't afford resources that.
Mm. Wow, yeah. No, you've got to.
And the external chairpersons tend to formalize these matters. Mm-hmm. Like, they make it almost like a criminal inquiry, where it really doesn't need to be. It could be a lot looser, a lot more like just a discussion about what had happened, depending obviously on the complexity of the situation. Sure. Okay, here's a topic that I really don't understand and have never understood, and it's medical boarding. So this young lady called Melanie has written in. She says, my husband had a leg amputation and his trade was as a truck driver. His work wants to medically board him. What does that mean? Does that mean he will never be able to apply for work? Or is he just not allowed to work as a driver? And what does it mean? And what happens if you are medically boarded? Who pays you? How do you get an income? What is it all about?
Do you know about that?
Okay, let me. Okay. Medically boarded, right? Like she said, husband, leg, can't drive, therefore can't work.
Right.
But before they even reach that stage of medically boarding him, isn't there something that they can do within the organization? Mm. Because obviously for this position as a driver,
they can't be a driver, but can he do some admin?
Exactly. Okay. Because they also look at, you know, medically boarded, they split it into two, temporary incapacity or permanent incapacity. So temporary incapacity, if maybe say I bang my head against the desk, and then I'm temporarily incapacitated, I can't, I have a headache, whatever. I won't have a headache forever. Okay, I'm not a medical person, but I won't have a headache, you know, forever, and won't be able to work. Maybe for a day I'll have a headache, and then tomorrow I can come to work. That's fine.
Yeah.
But then if it's medically, permanent incapacity, there has to be a medical report from the doctor to ascertain the length or the severity of the injury, the doctor to say, actually, no, this person cannot work in that position again.
In this situation, would you need that? I mean, he doesn't have a leg. It's obvious. Do you need a doctor to come and tell you that he can't drive?
What if someone can argue that? What if they get
an automatic
or a
prosthetic?
Yes.
Right.
So now, I believe that there's no need for being medically boarded, because even if he can't get a automatic truck, maybe the company can't afford it or whatever the case may be, is there nothing that he can do within the organization? Because for a company to medically board a person, that's when you can't now.
Okay.
You just
can't. That's generally sort of, you know, one would look to try and accommodate him elsewhere in the business. Now, let's take this situation. I'm assuming, though, it's implied that there is no alternative. They can't accommodate him, so they're applying to medically board. they've got risk benefits attached to their pension or provident fund. So a doctor would have to certify him as being incapacitated, either temporarily or permanently, and then those benefits would kick in. Now, once you're in receipt of such a benefit, you may not work. That's the rule. Okay, so you'll earn 75% of your salary. Now, you're saying, but that's 75% of my salary, which means I've lost 25.
Mm.
Effectively, what's happened is you're no longer going to and from work.
So you don't need that extra 25%.
Exactly. So that's how the insurance, I can't remember exactly the terminology that they use.
So what's called the insurance, they call it a risk benefit.
It's a risk benefit.
Yeah. Whereas they say that if you get...
So the company takes out insurance for this.
Correct.
Is it mandatory?
No, not all companies have it.
Not all companies have it.
Well, it's usually attached to... It's paid via a conduit through the pension or provident fund.
Right.
Some companies just have a separate group life and risk benefit permanent disability cover separately. Not all companies have it. In which case, he would have to apply for unemployment benefits through UIF.
Oh, wow.
Or workman's compensation if the accident was work-related.
Right.
So there are a whole lot of different things. But if you're in receipt of one of those risk benefits, then you're not allowed to work. And if you do work for an income, you have to declare it to the insurer, who will reduce your benefit in line with whatever you're getting. So no, it doesn't mean you can't work. It means that while you're in receipt of that 75%, you can't work for an additional income unless you declare it. And then... You will have to go for regular medical assessments so the underwriters can decide whether to continue the benefit or not.
How long does this benefit usually last? For the rest of your life?
Most policies,
until retirement age?
Most of these policies are structured in such a way that it's for the first 2 years.
Hmm.
You can't do the job for which you were hired at this company.
Hmm.
And thereafter, any job.
You can't do any job for...
No.
Okay.
But obviously within reason, because if you were the managing director and you slipped and broke your leg or whatever, and then 3 years later they offer you the job of a cleaner in the warehouse, it's not a reasonable alternative. So one would look at what is reasonable.
Right.
Mm. Right. Oh, interesting.
It is interesting. Chilisana, you've got something
to add. I just wanted to add that I would hope that, you know, in terms of such cover, it would depend on the type of work that you do. Because some industries, maybe say you're a truck driver, that's dangerous. That's a high-risk occupation. So surely companies should take out some sort of insurance for the employees, which some, like you said, some don't, some do. So really, being an employer really is stressful. It comes with more obligations than you at the point in time. If you don't, you know, look into the future or look ahead, it could hurt you in the long run. Because there are lots of things that you don't think about. Then once you've hired a person, and then it's an obligation on your part that you have to do certain things.
Sure.
That you...
The one thing that's mandatory is workman's compensation.
Yeah.
So you have to belong to... You have to pay the contributions over to that fund every year, and it's based on your annual salary roll. So that offers the employee some protection from occupational injuries and diseases, obviously.
Right.
It's not finite protection. And in addition to that, you would get group life cover or PHI, which is permanent health insurance. Maybe. Not all companies have it, and it's not compulsory.
Okay. Okay, last question. We're really running out of time.
Hmm.
We only got through about an eighth. So the last question, if an employee is involved in a domestic violence incident and is arrested, ending in a criminal record, does this open a door for a disciplinary action and dismissal?
Oh, this is a very interesting one. I know a lot of soccer players.
I'll say no. Because not that I'm condoning domestic abuse and violence,
let's take the domestic violence out. Let's say it's a drunken driving.
Yeah, but then now I'd say no. How did that yes with, not no with, proviso. How did that incident affect your
ability
to do your job
and your relationship with your employer?
Exactly. Did it taint the company's name in any way, shape, or form? If maybe you go to work in shorts and a shirt, you do whatever, it doesn't affect the company in any shape, in any shape or form. But if you wear a uniform and you're seen maybe bashing your wife or whatever,
yes, that affects the reputation of the business.
Then it's that Cliff Central employee was doing this, so now it's like, oh, that's now Cliff Central hire,
condone that,
yeah, condone such a thing. So now it's almost depends on, you know,
the seniority of the position that you hold.
Yeah.
Because I believe in a certain positions, you when you talk, you don't talk in your own capacity. You talk under the umbrella of a particular brand. So that brand at all points in time needs to be in your mind. I really think then it also depends. Because I think they've got a leg to stand on.
Mm-hmm.
I know some people who have actually been driving recklessly because they've given a car and as a brand ambassador, and once they found that they were reckless, they took the car back and they were simply saying, you no longer
have that car. Yeah. Do you know what the fastest car in the world is?
A Bugatti, I think.
No, a rental car.
Oh.
Alright, we are pretty much out of time. It's been really fascinating. Thank you so much. Do you want to make any closing remarks? Or?
No, I loved the experience. Thank you. Lovely to meet you, Lanan. Chili Tanani. And thank you, Saul. Thank you, everybody, for hosting us.
Big pleasure having you here. Chili Tanani, anything to
add? Closing remarks, just to employees, raise your voice. If you're unhappy about something, please don't keep quiet. It doesn't matter. Escalate it to whoever. Don't look at the whole thing of authority and whatever.
Don't let it ride.
Yeah, please. And also have paper trail to back up whatever you say. Or emails. Whatever someone tells you, please, yes, back yourself up. Because hearsay, he said, she said, that doesn't really hold water. So always back yourself up and raise your voice.
Thank you so much, Chili Tanani. Chili Tanani of the Labor Law Enterprise.
Correct.
And Jackie Perkis of the Fair Labor Practice. Lionel, thank you very much for being here. As usual, an absolute pleasure.
Merci.
Yeah, merci, danke.
Au revoir.
All the rest. Guten Tag, everybody.
Guten Tag.
That was The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg, but it's me, Saul Smith.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
This is CliffCentral.com.